This is The Bandwagon, a podcast about baseball peaking too early and you getting to pick the Phillies over me. I'm Hannah Kaiser, a baseball writer at Yahoo Sports, joined as always by Zach Kreiser, also a baseball writer at Yahoo Sports. Hello.
Hello.
I'm in South Jersey. I was going to say I'm in Philly, but no, I'm in South Jersey to see the Phillies, and somehow you will be bandwagoning the Phillies. Spoiler.
I will be bandwagoning the Phillies later. I mean, it never stops you when people ask you where you're from, you say Philly. Exactly where you're sitting.
I'm from right here, this house. Yeah. Do your parents still live in the house you grew up in?
They did. Well, sort of. They do from age 9 on. We moved when I was a kid.
Gotcha. Okay. We moved when I was like 2, and now I'm in the house that my parents have lived in for, I guess, 31 years, if I remember correctly what age I was when we moved. It's sort of funny if you, now we're just talking about this. If your parents lived in the same house for like most of your childhood, you go through a long period where you think you wouldn't care if they moved. And now I've come out the other side. And now my parents do kind of want to move because they have they had 4 kids and now they have no kids at home. And so they're like, we have too many bedrooms, and they're like, maybe we should downsize. But we circled back around to now there are more people in the family because the kids have gotten older. We've gotten married. Some of us, not me, have had kids of our own. And now we're like, you can't get a smaller house now. The family's only getting bigger. So now I get to come home and sit in the same kitchen where I used to eat breakfast before elementary school and instead record a podcast with you. Hello.
Full circle.
Exactly.
Speaking of young kids, have you seen the movie Little Big League?
Wow. All right. You're like, let's not talk about our lives. We get quickly transitioned to the rundown. I appreciate that. I have not. I have no idea. You wrote this reference. I said, I don't get it. Then you said Pete Crow Armstrong. And I was like, okay. So tell me how that relates.
Okay. So Little Big League is a movie from the 90s in which a 12-year-old inherits ownership of the Minnesota Twins. Don't ask about the machinations. Doesn't really matter. So for some reason, they let the 12-year-old run the team. And in the movie, the actress who plays the 12-year-old's mom is Ashley Crow, who in real life became the mother of Pete Crow Armstrong. You don't want to know how many years after she made this movie, she became Pete Crow Armstrong's mom. Played a mom in Hollywood, 1994, became Pete Crow Armstrong's actual mom, 2002. All the baseball players are too young. So Pete Crow Armstrong was a top prospect for the Cubs. He came over in a trade from the Mets, and he got called up to the big leagues yesterday, Monday. So now that's just a little bit of a full circle moment again with a weird Hollywood twist there. I would love to ask her if she encouraged him to play baseball because she was into the game from the movie, if she took the movie role because she already liked baseball. What do you think the origin story of Pete Crow Armstrong and Little Big League is?
Did she have other roles?
Like, ever?
Yeah, I mean, like, I guess what I'm saying is the notable thing that Pete Crow Armstrong's mom was in Little Big League, or is the notable thing that Pete Crow Armstrong's mom is, like, a Hollywood actress?
I mean, I think she was a Hollywood actress. Yeah, her known for does not include, on IMDb, does not include
really?
Little Big League, so
okay,
that's so, not her biggest role. She was in Minority Report, apparently.
Oh, that's a good movie. Okay, so I guess what I mean, like, yes, all right. I understand that the she's not even. Oh, his parents. Is that also an actor? Apparently, known for roles in Turks. I don't know that. The Profile and Heroes. Do you know any of his dad's movies?
Oh, his mom was also in Heroes.
Oh, do you think it's how they met?
No, because he was born. So.
Wow. He's apparently in 2012. His dad was in the second season of American Horror Story. I'm seeing any of these things, to be clear. Okay. So I guess what I'm saying is I understand that the baseball connection here is cute. It's funny. It's like relevant. But actually, this is going to be if the Cubs have a nice little postseason run, this is going to be like the Lucas Giolito went to high school with all those other guys. Fact. You know what I mean? It's like, there's like always like some fact that everybody, that like the first time anybody hears it, they're like, this is crazy. I'm going to tell everyone. And then by like the championship series, everyone has heard this fact and it's on every broadcast.
Yeah. So, if the Cubs make the playoffs and you play a drinking game about this fun fact, you will get hammered.
I look forward to that aspect of it. I really do enjoy that about the postseason. This is sort of like, we're doing these postseason preview episodes and it's getting me excited for the postseason. And I like the fact that you, if you know nothing about, like, honestly, you could start watching baseball in October. You shouldn't. I enjoy all of it. All 6 months. It's great. Regular season. But like, you could start watching baseball in October and get caught up because baseball games happen every day. They're pretty long. There's, well, I was going to say there's a lot of dead time. Not as much dead time. More dead time in the postseason than there is in the regular season still, even with the pitch clock. But like, you'll learn all the fun, like you'll learn that Tyler Matzek was out of baseball a few years ago and now here he is pitching for the Atlanta Braves. You know what I mean? It's like the people's backstories become very distinctive narratives over the course of a baseball postseason. And now we have pre-identified the Pete Crow Armstrong. Is he, wait, no, he can't be on the postseason roster because he got called up too late. Scratch
no, that's
everything
not how it works.
I just
you
said.
Just,
oh,
no. You just have to be in the organization. You don't have to be in the majors.
Oh, okay. All right, good. Never mind. Forget that part. He will be in the postseason. We will be talking about this. They will be panning to Ashley Crow and her husband, Matthew John Armstrong. And they'll be like, they'll be asking them things like, when you were in Little Big League, did you think someday? And we'll finally get the answer to that, to bring it back to your original question.
Maybe we will.
That is, honestly, you know what? Pocket that thought, because that will be a reason to root for the Cubs, is Pete Crow Armstrong. Well, Pete Crow Armstrong and Pete Crow Armstrong's parents, sort of as 1A and 1B, or maybe like 2A and 2B. I don't know. I'm not going to name them the number one reason to root for the Cubs, but I do think that that would be like a fun story to have unfold over the course of the postseason. But we are not talking about the Cubs this week, and we're not talking about that would have been a great transition if we were going right to the teams we're talking about, but we're not because we have other banter that we want to get to. You labeled this creative 2023 base running. And then if I click on the link or producer John clicks on the link or if anyone clicks on the link, which they can't do while listening to a podcast, they would see a video that you are now going to describe to us. Describe it to us.
So Monday night, the Toronto Blue Jays and the Texas Rangers started a very important series because the Texas Rangers have fallen out of the AL wildcard picture. The Toronto Blue Jays have risen into it, mostly because the Rangers have been so bad. And they started a series last night. They're playing each other. So Chris Bassitt was pitching for the Blue Jays, and the Rangers got a man on third base, Mitch Garver, and Chris Bassitt had used up his two disengagements under the new running rules for 2023. And so what Mitch Garver did is he just walked right down the baseline. No one, you know, you don't usually get held on at third base, so no one was holding him on. He walked all the way to the middle of the baseline, and Chris Bassitt, perhaps just engaged in baseball instincts, ran at him. He ran off the mound and ran at him, which is the right move if stepping off the mound didn't automatically create a balk. So, you know, Mitch Garver had to get back to the bag. He did. And once Bassitt did not get him out, he was automatically awarded home for a run, and not only because of this, but the Rangers ended up winning the game. So that was an interesting little duel that only became possible, a little mental game that only became possible because of the new base running rules.
I have not thought this through, and so possibly I'm about to say something very stupid, because I was, as you were talking, I was like, we should talk through what should Chris Bassitt have done. Should he have just thrown home, and then if the catcher thinks they can pick him off, the catcher can throw over to third? Like, what is, how could he have avoided this? Because you're right, the base runner was like all the way halfway down the line. So you have to, I understand the temptation to want to sort of chase the base runner back to the bag so he's not getting such a large lead towards home plate, which is, you know, the whole, his end game, literally. But what could he have done to prevent the balk, but also control the running game. Because it's not like the runner was, I don't think the runner was trying to steal home. So it's not an issue.
I don't think
of,
Mitch Garver was going to steal home.
Right. No. So it's not like, oh, you know, you're trying to get the pickoff. He was literally just trying to get him to retreat away from home base. What would have been the best tactic?
Well, the best tactic would have been to not use up his two engagements, disengagements before. Other than that, he had to throw the pitch.
Yeah, he should have just pitched, right?
He had to throw the pitch, or they had to have some sort of mechanism by which he could signal to the third baseman to go over there and cover, because the third baseman was nowhere near the bag. Right. It's not like there was some easy way to get out of that. So he just had to throw the pitch or not use up his disengagements before that.
Is this what you're going to write about when you write about postseason base running?
Part of it. Yeah, I think I'm going to ask some people about it. The best team at limiting the running game this year has been the Arizona Diamondbacks, and they are in New York this week. So I will go ask them how they do that.
Because you're right. It's like we're at the point in the season where you feel like they should have encountered every possible scenario, but obviously they haven't. Sometimes you don't have a guy covering third and there's a guy on third and you've already used up your two. Like, there's actually like a lot of different permutations, and we've seen the kind of runner on first who may try to steal second. How should they control that? Play out a lot, but there's going to be weirder ones. You texted me about this Brewers failed no-hit attempt, because on Sunday I was not paying attention to baseball. I went to see Bottoms in theaters. It was only okay, honestly. I have thoughts. I thought the writing was funny. The acting was incredible. The plot barely hung together. They should have taken a second pass at that. However, I got out of that and I was like, what did I miss? And a lot. So catch me up on this near no-hitter that the Brewers lost. Or the, what do we call it? If the no, if the, it was a nine-inning no-hitter that the Brewers lost in extras to the Yankees.
Yes.
Who then lost Jason Dominguez. And Luis Severino?
Right.
A lot of losing.
And not in the same game, but Corbin Burnes took a no-hitter through eight and was very good. This is not that surprising. He won the Cy Young recently. You know. So Corbin Burnes, great game. He did not come out for the ninth. They took him out, just pitch limits, that sort of thing. They made it through the ninth, but the Brewers had never scored either. So they just kept going. And actually, the play of the game was probably in the 10th inning. There was a fly ball. Anthony Volpe of the Yankees hit a fly ball out to right center. And Joey Weimer and Sal Frelick, the two Brewers outfielders, converged, both going very hard to try to preserve the no-hitter, and collided both with each other and with the wall at the same time. And Sal Frelick made the catch and also elbowed Joey Weimer in the lip. And I think the image of this non-no-hitter, as it turned out, was Joey Weimer running off the field, like, bloody mouth, just like, yeah, woo! So the Brewers ended up losing the no-hitter in the 11th, and they lost the game eventually after several more twists and turns. So it turned out to be an extra innings game that doesn't look like it was a no-hitter, but it was the latest no-hitter that anyone has lost in, I think, since the 1960s. So very rare to have a no-hitter taken into the 11th.
It is extremely low-hanging fruit to be like, wow, that's some Brewer shit. But it really is. I went and their like roster resource page just to make sure I wasn't, I don't know, slandering them with prior years. But no, they're back to being very good at pitching and not so great at hitting. Like, this is what happens when you put together a team that's pretty good. That's winning a division. Winning a division still? Winning a division still. Mm-hmm. And yet they are 25th in batting average, 23rd in home runs, 18th in runs scored. It's like, yeah, maybe a little bit more offense. I'm home, I'm seeing my parents, as I mentioned. And this is not about the Brewers at all. This is just about the waiver claims and the I got to do the fun summing up of the Angels waiver claims, in which they were like, what happened to all those guys? Did they end up on Cleveland? And I was like, well, the pitchers ended up on the Guardians and the hitters ended up on the Reds, even though that's not how it should have gone. That has nothing to do with the Brewers. It just made me think of that, where I'm kind of like, the pitching was good, but that stands to reason. The part that they need to be better was not. All right. I really want to talk about the George Kirby stuff. So Let's do that. I'm so interested. I perhaps because Twitter is no good now, I feel like I heard people say like, wow, there was so much discourse, so much backlash. And I heard that before I heard the discourse or the backlash. So I got to come, I got to form my own opinion, which like never happens in this day and age. And then catch up on what everybody else's opinion was and be like, wow, you guys are really mad. Over the weekend. No, on Friday night. Over the weekend. The Mariners were in Tampa playing the Rays. That's a fun series. It's a very Hannah series. I tried to watch a lot of those games. I somehow didn't watch this one, though. The George Kirby was having a rough start. So he missed a couple starts because he was sick. Or he missed one start at least because he was sick. He's got to start push back. And he's been on a little bit of a rough stretch. And he walked two batters and hit another in the first inning. That never happens. He's like setting some all-time record for strikeout to walks. Then he was good for a while. The Mariners were up 4-2. At 93 pitches through six innings, he went back out to pitch the seventh, surrendered a two-run home run, and the Mariners went on to lose the game. After the game, George Kirby said, "I wish I wasn't out there for the seventh, to be honest. I was at 90 pitches. I didn't think I needed to go anymore, but it is what it is." Naturally, somebody asked, "Did you talk to Scott Service about that?" He did not actually answer that directly. He just said, "There will be a conversation soon," which I take to mean he hadn't spoken to him about it in game. He's since apologized, but there was backlash, all of that. But I'm going to give you the chance that I had, which was to have a reaction to that before I learned about all of the backlash. So what was your initial reaction to George Kirby saying, "I didn't think I should be out there for the seventh"?
It's honesty, which you kind of want from someone when you're interviewing them, as we've talked about with Shohei Ohtani not talking to anyone. Like, I'll take the insight that he provided here. It's also, you know, when George Kirby first came up, there was a lot of talk about, oh, he's like got an edge to him. He's really competitive. Yeah. And this was probably the first time we've actually seen it in some really public way where he really didn't think he was the best option to get through that seventh inning. And yeah, it's a young pitcher. He probably doesn't want to go to his manager and say, "Hey, I don't think I should be in there." But the flip side of that is you probably don't want to say it to reporters before you say it to the manager later. That's a perfectly fine moment to go and say, "Actually, I think I was at my limit. How do we want to talk about that in the future?" He told the reporters that, and so it was probably a more uncomfortable conversation than it needed to be. But I didn't have an issue with... if you look around baseball, that's very normal. That's a pretty typical time for a pitcher to come out, especially against a really good lineup. It's not like there was a soft underbelly of the Rays lineup for him to carve through at 85% strength. Like, he was gonna face good hitters and it didn't go well. And so I don't mind his rationale. I think obviously he recognizes he probably should have told someone else before he told the media, but I didn't really have an issue with it.
Yeah. So the immediate reaction was like, well, pitchers are weak these days. And specifically that, like, he is weak and doesn't deserve, like, there were literally like reactions from former players that were kind of like, how could someone even deserve to be in the majors if they don't want to pitch? Which I think what George picked, I don't like to take the position of like, he shouldn't have said that to the media, because we are media. And like, you start off saying, love honesty. And also, I just like to know the dynamics at play. If this is how George Kirby feels, I'd like to know that. I'd also just like to know the dynamics at play that are like, I don't know. I like, do it for the plot, George, like say it to the media for the plot. I don't want to dig too much into like, why did he say that? I do think what he did wrong was mention the pitch count, because I think he had a, like, I don't think I have enough to get through this inning, these hitters, whatever. I understand he was facing the bottom of the lineup. That is a selfless comment to sort of say, like, I'm not sure I'm the best option for this upcoming inning. That is putting the team before yourself. That's self-knowledge, self-awareness, that's humility. once he mentioned the pitch count, it was suddenly like open season for on modern pitchers and how come they can't even throw a complete game type thing. And I feel like there actually are sort of two separate points, which is like, are guys built up enough to throw nine innings, throw 120 pitches, whatever it is, versus in this particular day, this particular pitcher with the stuff he has had through six innings so far, like, is he capable of giving his team the best chance of winning in this next frame? Like, those feel like very different issues. And I think he meant it to be about the latter, but the discourse ended up being about the former because of the sort of 90 pitch count that he mentioned. So George, that's where you went wrong. Just some facts. George Kirby is 19th in innings pitched this year, which is not the highest, but it's not like, the issue is like George Kirby as a person is not like diva who insists on being coddled type situation. That's my point. Like, I think he just thought self-assessment. Don't think I got the stuff not right. The yeah. Like, yeah. And there doesn't seem to be anything wrong or even like especially new or noteworthy about that. Like, that's got, you know, pitching coaches and pitchers or managers and pitchers have that kind of conversations with guys presumably all the time between innings. Why it didn't happen now, I don't know. That feels like something the Mariners should figure out, which is like I said, he got off to an uncharacteristically wild for George Kirby start in this game. So why it was that they weren't regularly checking in to see if he felt like he had enough left in the tank to get through the next inning is also sort of curious to me. Bob Nightingale wrote about this, and here's the lead on Bob Nightingale's story. I really don't like our podcast to be media criticism, but I'm sorry. He wrote, Seattle Mariners young starter George Kirby, an all-star for the first time this year and a vital part of their playoff push, found himself as perhaps the most vilified player in the game Saturday, thanks to a single soundbite. And we're not going to talk about Julio Urias again, even though there were some updates, but I just feel like that was maybe a really bad framing. Like,
it was vilified. And if you were taking a really narrow definition of the game.
Yes. But I don't mean that to be a joke about Urias. I genuinely mean that to be a commentary on the framing of what George Kirby did, which is like, even if you thought he was wrong, I listened to the Mets broadcast, and of course they talked about this because they are great about talking about all the issues in the game. And I even sort of thought they were being a little bit histrionic, but they talked about like, this is the issue with the way that kids are raised from childhood in the game right now to sort of prioritize long-term health. They even brought in the element of how players don't get paid when they're young and pitchers are concerned about their own health because they know that an injury, like, I thought they had a really interesting holistic conversation, and to reduce that down to vilification actually like is doing a disservice even to the histrionic form of the discourse, which I think has some interesting underlying points. And the interesting underlying points aren't like, is George Kirby a bad guy? Because this has nothing to do with that. So I don't know. That's my rant about it. I also really like George Kirby, so I'm a little bit biased. But I felt really sad for him. I was listening to a different podcast earlier today, and they were like, this is going to be the thing everyone knows about George Kirby. And I was like, damn, that might be true. And he is a very talented young pitcher who, like I said, is like setting all-time records for his strikeout to walk ratio, which is like sounds like a very specific point, but generally just means like, wow, it's a pitcher with a lot of control, especially for a 25-year-old. He was an all-star. I don't know. He's on the Mariners. They're going to be in the postseason. He pitched in that 18-inning game against the Astros last year where they didn't win, but it wasn't because of him because he held them scoreless for a very long time. So this is just to say, please don't, if you are a person who is only learning about George Kirby through this incident, don't stop learning about him. There's some actual good baseball to know there. That's all.
Yeah, George Kirby is the exact type of pitcher who is built to go deep in games in this day and age, and I imagine he will go deep into some very prominent games. So let's, you know, maybe it'll be like the Anthony Rendon thing from April that everyone actually forgot about when I thought they'd remember it. So ooh, maybe this too will fade. It seems that everyone has forgotten about it. So
please splice that together with Zach saying last week that like people did not forget about
it. Still,
it could still be the standout. You're like, you know what? I still think that the standout storyline from the 2023 Angels.
Just a memorable harbinger of doom, not the standout storyline.
All right. We're going to take a quick break and then we are going to come back with a bandwagon of the two wild card leaders, because some of these divisions, man, they're still very much up for grabs. All right, this is our third postseason preview episode. And like I said, in the first two, we're going by most assured to least assured. So by the time we get there, they'll be assured. And we thought we'll probably knock out the division leaders first. No, we won't, because some of these divisions are very close still, which is cool, division races. So instead, we are venturing into the top two wild cards for each league. And we are going to start with the reigning NL pennant winners, the Philadelphia Phillies. Zach, take it away.
The Philadelphia Phillies. Last year's NL pennant winners. This year's definitely going to win the wild card. Definitely not going to be anywhere close to the Braves. They're playing the Braves this week, and the Braves might clinch the division also this week. So, but this is sort of the Phillies thing. Were you a Mario Kart person? Did you play Mario Kart when you were a kid? Or not a kid? Whenever?
I didn't play anything else, but I have had, sporadic Mario Kart experiences.
Do you know the Star Power power-up?
No. It's lost me already.
Oh.
Sorry.
Okay. So, it's been a while. In Mario Kart, if you get Star Power, you basically just become super fast, and you can pass a bunch of people, and if you get it at the right time, it's very helpful. And this is the Phillies to me. They do not have the roster to go through a regular season and win just on the power of their own merits. Because their like 20th guy is not very good. Their bullpen is sometimes leaky. They kind of end up every season having to spackle together something that doesn't quite work the way they thought. But when they get to like winning three games that they really need to win, or say needing to push into the playoffs or win in the playoffs, what they do have is like five superstars. And we saw it last year. I wrote about it last year that can be a particularly helpful formula in the playoffs. Dave Dombrowski, who is the president of baseball operations for the Phillies, basically builds all his teams like this. He likes to pay like six guys a lot and then figure out the rest. And the Phillies have the very well-known stars. It's Bryce Harper. It is Kyle Schwarber. It is Zach Wheeler on top of the rotation. And this year, it's JT Realmuto behind the plate. This year, it's now Trey Turner at shortstop. And I think the story of this year's Phillies in particular revolves around Trey Turner, who was bad for the first April, May, June, July, 4 months of the season. He was bad. And he hasn't really ever been bad. He's been a speed-only guy, a speed and average guy earlier in his career, but he really unlocked power in 2020, and since then, he's been a straight-up superstar, MVP candidate. He obviously got a lot of money in free agency from the Phillies, so it was kind of a Space Jam lost his powers situation for a little bit, and what happened in Philly was pretty much, you know, I'm not besmirching your native city, but it was kind of anti-Philly what they did. Instead of booing him relentlessly or like making voodoo dolls of him or something, or like burning his likeness, they started cheering him like as a matter of course. They put together a little campaign, sort of Nick Castellanos inspired, and a radio host got involved and told fans to cheer for him. And the first week of August, when this really took hold, he broke out. He's hit like 14 homers this month. Well, since August 1st, it's not August anymore. He's hit a lot of homers. He's suddenly back to looking like himself. And when you look at the Phillies' record and try to say, well, is that team really going to compete in the NL playoffs against the Phillies and the Dodgers? the biggest reason this year that the Phillies are not their record is Trey Turner. And also Bryce Harper has gotten stronger from injury and can play the field now. So it's another Phillies team that will be much more dangerous in October than they looked the rest of the season.
Right. If anything, they are peaking slightly too soon because it does feel like Trey Turner can't make an out and Kyle Schwarber is hitting lots of leadoff home runs and challenging what we think of as leadoff guys. I should caution, they did boo him for a while. You were like, unlike their reputation, they didn't boo him. It's like, no, they booed him first. I was, I'm here in Philly, I was talking to the Braves. A Braves player, who I'll let stay unnamed, was saying to me that, I was like, oh, is your wife going to travel for the postseason? We were talking about they have a kid and like what they were going to do. And he was like, yeah, probably not here though. She did not like being here last year. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I was like, I hate that for the wives of the opposing teams. And he was like, oh no, as a sports fan, I think it's great. He's like, she didn't like it. But I think it's really cool that the Phillies people are like, he's like, this is like the loudest. And that's another reason to root for the Phillies, not to jump on your bandwagon. But they really, this is like a cheesy, dumb thing to say. They really do get loud in the postseason. Yesterday was a Monday doubleheader, and the attendance for the first game, well, the announced attendance was 30,000, which I'm now realizing may have been from the rainout, but there were a lot of people at that first game of a Monday doubleheader, like enough that other people in the press box were mentioning it. Also, like Trey Turner had an infield hit and then Bryce Harper homered to tie it in the ninth inning, and then they ended up losing because the Braves are still the Braves, but it was a lot of fun, and I was like, this Phillies team is fun. This is going to be not our best episode in terms of balance because the Phillies are maybe more fun than the spoiler raised while the bandwagoning, at least especially right now, and especially in terms of like vibes. If you want to talk like who's a better baseball team, we can have a more interesting conversation. But vibes wise, the Phillies are a lot more fun.
There are not a lot of baseball teams that have better vibes than this particular iteration of the Phillies. And I don't mean just this year. I mean, like going back to last year, the combo of Bryce Harper being just a complete sponge for everything a city wants to hope or dream about, combined with Kyle Schwarber and Nick Castellanos being like a weird non sequitur comedy duo.
Right.
That entire thing just goes. The Eagles were good last year, which I think also helped put Philadelphia fans in this amazing mood. So the Philadelphia aura around the Phillies is really, really strong right now. And, you know, it could all go bust if they lose in the wild card series, but it feels like they're the type of team that isn't going to let it go easily. You know, Harper has really stepped into his own in the playoffs last year, and it feels like he's setting himself up to maybe make another run at getting that first World Series title. And especially in a season that is underlined how cursed Mike Trout and Shohei Ohtani have been with the Angels, it would be a little bit of a salve if Harper were able to make it a two-year narrative where he got there last year and now this year he actually gets the ring. I think that would, you know, there are lots of people who don't want Philly to win a World Series, but if you are a neutral, I think your exhilaration level would be pretty high if you decided you wanted to jump on the Bryce Harper Phillies bandwagon.
Yeah, last year in the World Series, they tied a baseball record for like most home runs in a World Series game. They are a fun team. This is a dumb thing to say because it's the whole point of the exercise. But they're a fun team to root for. Like they deliver on the rooting for. I thought actually like yesterday's game, even though they ended up losing in extra innings, that first game of the doubleheader was such a perfect example of that. Like it is really fun to root for a team that does the thing. Like one, hitting a lot of home runs is a good way to never be out of it. And two, to have like a Bryce Harper figure who feels like there are, you know, there's at least one guy like that on every team, but Bryce Harper feels like a particularly pathos-riddled example, if not quite Mike Trout, Shohei Ohtani level, to come up in the bottom of the ninth with two outs, down by two, with a guy on, and you're like, oh my God, is he going to do it? And then he did. He hit a home run. It's like, yeah, all right, cool. This is a good guy to root for. He's both very good and feels like a distinct kind of avatar for the team or for the city or for something like that. They love him here. He, however, moved out of Haddonfield, which is where I'm from, so that's fine. Maybe not even the first time I brought that up.
This is an extremely Philadelphia-flavored podcast. We are talking about the neighborhoods of the South Jersey yes. suburbs.
Oh, you want to hear something super Philadelphia-flavored?
Sure.
I was talking to Austin Riley yesterday. I don't know how we got on this, but I was like, where do you guys stay when you stay here? And then I was like, have you ever been to the Reading Terminal Market? Because that's what I say to everyone when I find out that they're like, anywhere in Philadelphia. And he was like, no. And I was like, so you don't even know what Scrapple is? And then I explained to him Scrapple. And then he was like, oh, I'm going to try that. And I was like, really? And he's like, yeah, you're going to be here tomorrow, which is now today. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, all right, I'll tell you. And I was like, all right, I'm going to text you the name. Because he was like, say that word again. And I was like, okay, I was going to text it to you. But Austin Riley has been sick. So then later I texted him, I was like, you know what? Actually, maybe don't get Scrapple. I was like, maybe save it for when you guys come back. So
just write it down.
Yeah, I was like, save this text. Don't go eat deep fried breakfast meat right now. Cause he's like, the Braves have had like a stomach bug. You actually texted me about this. And I was like, oh yeah, don't. I mean, maybe do sabotage. Go Phillies. But no, I think. So that is a distinctly Philadelphia flavored element of this podcast. I think that the I don't know if this is this possible? It's probably possible. The Braves and the Phillies should face off in the CS. That would be fun. That'd be a very good.
I think that is extremely possible.
Yeah, right?
The number one seed Braves would face the winner. Oh, nope. I think they'd face off in the DS, not the CS. Yeah. It would be the DS if all the standings stay the same, which it seems like those two will. It would be a DS series that those two teams would play.
Once again, I say to you, echoing producer John, wow, no faith in the Chicago Cubs. So we're only one game back of the Phillies, 1.5.
We'll get there. Someday we will bandwagon the Cubs, and I will have to reckon with them being pretty good.
With your total doubt in them as a team. Tell us about Zach Wheeler, a man who is forgotten by all of the graphics that are made on various sports talk programs when discussing NL Cy Young contenders.
I think the reason, well, okay, so Zach Wheeler has been a top five pitcher in baseball since he got to the Phillies. Not a great look for the Mets. Signed a great free agent deal with the Phillies and has been terrific the entire time. I think he's having the same issue that his teammate Aaron Nola has had a couple times with the Phillies, which is his surface level numbers don't look as good as all of the other numbers say they should. And that's probably because the Phillies defense leaves some things to be desired. And that's not Zach Wheeler's fault, but it does affect his overall rhythm of a season. It affects how his numbers end up looking. I think he could still very well get votes for the Cy Young. I think he's a great ace to start in game one of any playoff series you want. He is a really creative, dexterous pitcher who can create pitches and change them out on the fly. And he has a very deep arsenal because of all this. Also, he throws very hard. So, I think everyone should feel great about Zach Wheeler going into the playoffs. I think he's certainly better than any, he's more reliable, let's say, than any pitcher we know will be pitching for the Dodgers come October. So there's a real benefit to having a guy like him who throws a lot of innings, throws very well, and hopefully in the playoffs will get slightly better defense than he has gotten on a regular basis this year. So he's just he's a great guy to have atop your rotation, and he's also turning into kind of the mini Max Scherzer case of a great free agent pitcher signing that everyone always claims are impossible.
Remember last year when Nick Castellanos was like, I'm better at defense in the postseason because I pay attention? So,
yes.
That. I think that was Stephanie Maybe Epstein at Sports attention. Illustrated who reported that. Actually, this is going to take us derail, so I won't linger on it. I wish someone to check in on Nick Castellanos, how he's doing with the defense now that there's a pitch clock, because I've heard from multiple people that they're finding that the pitch clock is helping them on defense because they have to stay paying attention, that there's not as much time to like let your mind wander. And that's supposed to be better for the overall defenses. Did someone write about this? I think maybe they have. So I won't, but just a thought. Okay. I'm sorry that I made it sound in our Phillies bandwagon that I was not excited to bandwagon the Rays. I am. Let's talk about the Tampa Bay Rays, who are going to win the first wild card spot in the American League, right?
Right. Oh, if yeah. they don't win the division.
If they don't win the division. So right now, the Tampa Bay Rays are 3 games back of the Baltimore Orioles. I believe they play the Baltimore Orioles this weekend. Yes, I'm trying to like yep. type ball. Okay, they play them this weekend.
They do. Yep.
I will be at my brother's wedding, or else I'd probably have gone to Baltimore for that. But I will be sneaking a peek at my phone to check on the scores, because that's going to be a really impactful series. Because the American League wildcard teams in general are like significantly better than the National League wildcard teams. So a lot of teams that I wouldn't say deserve a bye, but perhaps have records that could get them a bye are going to be thrust into the mess of the short wildcard series. And atop that list are the Tampa Bay Rays, who are either going to win the division or get the first wildcard spot. They are 8.5 games up on the currently Toronto Blue Jays, who have the second wildcard spot. Whoa. All right. Look at that. Replacing both the Rangers and the Mariners in the second wildcard spot. But yeah, they are better than the other wild cards, in addition to being almost as good as the division winners. So that's a reason to root for them. They're very good. I actually thought, all right, we'll do the disclaimer first. Disclaimer, Wander Franco still leads the Tampa Bay Rays in position player war. So that's not fun at all.
It's a bummer.
It's a bummer when you go to their team page, for instance, or just when you think about them. Also really undermines part of what was their narrative at the beginning of the season when they were so successful, was like, what are you talking about? The Rays have stars. Look at this guy. Now they don't. They don't have him at all. Forget about that. That was a lie. Also, they have almost an entire, like, potentially best starting rotation in baseball on the injured list. Right now, their pitcher IL portion of the roster research page goes 60-day IL, Shane Baz, 60-day IL, Shane McClanahan, 60-day IL, Drew Rasmussen, 60-day IL, Jeffrey Springs. Those are a lot of really good starting pitchers who will not be participating in the rest of this baseball season. So they are not a reason to root for them. All right, let's talk about why you might root for them. They've never won a World Series. And if you forget about the fact that it was taking place during a pandemic, it was very fun when they were in the World Series in 2020. Remember that Brett Phillips game? That was great. So they do fun things. I thought this was interesting. Okay. Tom Verducci had an article. This article is about the Padres. It was about like how they can't hit with runners in scoring position. And I thought this was really interesting. He dug into, well, isn't hitting with runners in scoring position kind of a random stat? How does it like connect to overall success? And he found a pretty strong connection between specifically like postseason success and hitting with runners in scoring position. This is a chart via Tom Verducci. This is the rank of the batting average with runners in scoring position of the last however many World Series winners. So the Astros, they were second. The Braves, they were third. The Dodgers, they were second. The Nationals, they were fifth. The Red Sox, they were first. The 2017 Astros, they were first. The Rays this year are second in batting average to the Orioles with runners in scoring position, which I think is interesting because I like this exercise from Tom Verducci because it dovetails nicely with our concept of bandwagoning. Like, who will be a satisfying team to watch in the postseason? And actually, I thought that was like a strong argument in favor of rooting for the Rays, because not getting hits when there are runners in scoring position, especially in a high stakes game, it's a very frustrating watch. Like, that is just from a pure fan perspective. If you could pick a team to root for, you would not want to root for a team that is going to make an out when there's a runner in scoring position in a major game. That is like having spent some time around some baseball fans last night watching the second game of the doubleheader with my parents, I was like, oh man, fans hate that. So root for the Rays, because they are pretty good at hitting with runners in scoring position. They are second to Cincinnati in stolen bases. Cincinnati's also very fun. We will talk about them. That'll probably be one of the reasons to bandwagon Cincinnati, is that they're fun and they run a lot because they're young. The Rays also do that. And it feels in some ways contrary to the Rays, like, they only do the bare minimum they need to do to win type vibe. The like their willingness to take the extra base to I guess I can't think of like a specific example, but I've watched a lot of Rays games this year because I enjoy them. And they do a lot of like stole second and then on the next pitch stole third type which is always very fun. I put this on my list of reasons to root for the Rays. Hear me out. Randy Arozarena has led baseball in caught stealing the last 3 years, including when he won a Rookie of the Year.
I was going to say, he loves to run, whether it's a good move or not.
Randy loves to run, man. And I think leading baseball in caught stealing is a fun characteristic. Like, as long as you also are pretty good at stealing, which he is, like, that just means you're going for it. That's a cool way to be. That is a player. Well, we know Randy's going for it, but he really, really is. He's really embraced the folded arms thing. Does that a lot. Probably better in small sample size. So if you haven't seen it yet, continue to not see it and then watch some postseason games. And you'll be like, what? That's amazing when he does it for like the first time in a postseason game. That, think about, let me ask you, when do you think he started doing that?
Oh boy. I don't remember him doing it during his like big rookie 2020 postseason, but if you told me he did, I'd believe you, but I think he started it the next spring.
No, he started this spring in the World Baseball Classic.
Oh,
and already okay. It feels like he's been doing it.
It's a meme. Yeah.
Yeah, like I was like, wow, that went from, I was reading a big story about him in ESPN, and they were like, when he did that in the World Baseball Classic, and I was like, that's the first time he did that. Just like he always does the crossed arms thing. But recognizable figure, really a fun, like a one of the most fun, distinctive on-field personalities, like where you can interpret their personality through what they do on the field. Also, Tyler Glasnow. I'm looking at my notes. I'm like, surely I made some notes about Tyler Glasnow. I did not. I just watched him pitch last night and was like, that's a reason to root for the Rays. Tyler Glasnow. I think of Tyler Glasnow as being a more famous, more sort of like universally recognized upper echelon pitcher than he is, because he's been hurt a lot. The Rays, like, he's been sort of like, he's never made an all-star team, for instance. He's never made an all-star team, never finished in the top 10 for Cy Young voting. And I think when he is healthy, when he's on the mound, when he's pitching well, he's like, I don't know, I'm gonna go out on a limb and say the most dominant pitcher in baseball who doesn't have any of those accolades. And I think this year when he's pitching well, he's got a 1.32 ERA plus, he's got a 2.93 FIP. Like this year when he's pitching well would be a fun kind of like, it's sort of weird to think of this as like a, I don't know, like a coming out party or whatever, but for Tyler Glasnow, who's in his eighth season, but he's really good and he deserves a big national stage. Especially before he goes into his last season under contract for the Tampa Bay Rays, and potentially, if doesn't get traded, then is in his walk year before he probably ends up somewhere with more fans, if not more successful. This is a really roundabout way of saying I enjoy watching Tyler Glasnow pitch. I especially enjoy watching Tyler Glasnow get frustrated or excited while he's pitching and very obviously curse. The most famous example of which is when Kevin Kiermaier made a very good catch and then he said, mother Kev, every goddamn time. But we could see him say that so clearly. And then yesterday, this is a good Tyler Glasnow story. Yesterday, first inning, he was pitching very well and he had the makings of an immaculate inning against the Minnesota Twins. And then the eighth pitch of the inning, he struck out the first two guys on three pitches each, had two strikes on the second guy. Then I think it was the eighth pitch of the inning, he threw a ball and you could hear on the broadcast, he goes, and then he strikes him out. And so it was like a 10 pitch, immaculate, not immaculate inning. And he was so mad when he came off the mound and, that's not great. Control your emotions a little bit, but oh, cool. That's a cool pitcher right there. He was mad that he didn't have an immaculate inning. He struck out the side and was like, not enough. And
that is going to be a lot of bleeps in a row on the pod.
Yeah. Do we bleep our pod? I don't listen. I mean, I listen to you when we're talking, but.
I think we bleep, yes. We are a family show.
Oh, okay. That's my pitch for Tyler Glasnow. He plays chess. He's very tall. This is my Tyler Glasnow, like, bit that you and I have talked about. Tyler Glasnow is very tall and very beautiful, and very good at baseball. And I was talking to someone in the Rays recently, and they were like, he's really smart and really nice, too. And I was like, God damn it, that too? He's like, you know how sometimes it's like people are really good looking and then they don't develop a good personality? He's kind of like circled back around to like, he's really nice to everyone and is like a total delight to be around and has like cultivated hobbies and other interests because like, why not? These are everything.
Yeah, he's the unfair. He's got too many of the good genes.
Yeah, he's got too many of the good genes. He's the John Hamm character in 30 Rock where it's like, life is amazing. And you're like, for you, sure. That's how I feel about Tyler Glasnow, but also a very fun pitcher to watch and to root for. The pitching is good in general. Also, they have a good bullpen, and a good bullpen is another one of those, like, from a pure, if you didn't see the logos or the names on the jerseys, hitting with runners in scoring position and not blowing games is like a good formula for a non-devastating watch from a fan perspective. So just that's my like, they're probably not going to break your heart as long as you don't read the news. All right. We have had some breaking news, speaking of.
Breaking news during the recording.
All right. Hit us with the breaking news, Zach.
Jeff Passan and Mark Feinsand, several people now reporting that the Mets are hiring David Stearns as the next president of baseball operations. He will take over following the end of the regular season. If you're not familiar, David Stearns was the GM of the Milwaukee Brewers until this past offseason when he took kind of a mysterious, wanted to step away and take a year off type situation. I think he remained as an advisor to the Brewers, technically. But Brewers owner Mark Adonasio had denied the Mets the ability to interview him, which he's contractually able to do, prior to the season and prior in their previous search when they wound up with Billy Epler. Billy Epler and David Stearns, I think the reporting is they are friends and that Billy Epler will remain as GM and David Stearns will slot in over top of Epler at the Mets organization. This is the Mets' Andrew Friedman hire. This is what they're trying to do. They are trying to take a guy who built a really, really successful organization with not the most resources, give him all the resources he could ever imagine, and see if he can create sustained winning with the Mets. It's hard to think of a more qualified executive who was there for the taking and who you'd want to be taking, who was never like suspended by MLB or something. Jeff Luhnow exists, but no one's hiring him.
That's true. Instead, they're hiring David Stearns, who was Jeff Luhnow's right-hand man in Houston. And I don't mean that as a sarcastic comment. I mean that as like a literal, like, Jeff Luhnow was very good, and David Stearns was a big part of that, and left before 2017, crucially.
So David Stearns is taking over the New York Mets. This will, we'll find out a lot more once he actually gets in the building and starts to make changes or do whatever he's going to do. But he's a New York City guy, grew up a Mets fan. The writing seemed to be on the wall about this for like 2 years.
Yes. This is like the most notable thing is that it's not notable at all. Like that we've already analyzed this. I pulled up while you were talking the notes I made last time I was on SNY's Baseball Night in New York, because one of the topics was like, why is David Stearns a perfect fit for the New York Mets? So this is not a shock. This is only a shock because smart, good job, Steve Cohen. He's like a smart businessman, hired David Stearns now before I guess other people got around to doing it, because I know there was speculation that like maybe the Astros, where he used to be, would be interested in bringing him back, something like that. So this is the Mets getting their guy. Like, the surprising part is that it worked out for the Mets. The unsurprising part is that they wanted to hire David Stearns, in addition to having like been really successful in Milwaukee. Between his first and second year in Milwaukee, the Brewers upped their record by 13 games and then by 10 games between years two and three. That's not all attributable to him, because it takes a while for like top baseball executives to have an impact, but it's like worth noting. I thought this was interesting. So the Mets have finally launched their pitching lab, their quote unquote pitching lab, which everybody has. And when Steve Cohen addressed the media at some point this year and sort of talked about what a disappointing year it was, he explicitly sort of was like, well, we've finally got this pitching lab. We're obviously behind the industry with that. And this is not to say that like that the words pitching lab necessarily refer to like the exact same thing everywhere, or that technology hasn't evolved. But I was looking into like the Brewers. They famously are good at developing pitching. When did they open what they call their quote unquote pitching lab? And that was before spring training 2019. So this is, so like, the David Stearns is very good and very successful. He's had a lot of success in the small market. And specifically, he's someone who has a lot of years of experience overseeing pitching development through this kind of technology. So that is something that will hopefully help the Mets like catch up in that way.
Yeah, I think if you're looking for someone to come in and install a modern pitching pipeline, you know, again, short of hiring someone away from the Dodgers, the Brewers are pretty much as good as you're going to find. So Stearns coming in will certainly, it should have an impact on the Mets in a positive way. We'll see how much groundwork needs to be laid for him to start bringing results up to the big league level. But this is Steve Cohen getting his white whale and, things working out for the Mets. Wild times.
All right, that is all that we've got for you this week. Thank you to producer John for making the podcast look and sound great. Make sure you're following us on Twitter/X, Threads, Blue Sky, Instagram, anywhere that people are being social online. If you've made it this far, subscribe to the podcast, the YouTube channel, leave us a 5-star review. Definitely tell your friends, even if they didn't listen the whole regular season. Now is a great time to jump in, get ready for the postseason. Like I was saying, you can start watching baseball in October and still have a pretty good time. And then if they did that, they could catch up by listening to these postseason preview episodes, which we will have another one of next week, another episode of The Bandwagon.